My guest is science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. When he started writing science fiction in the 1930s, he didn't expect that fantasies like space travel and nuclear power would be realities in his lifetime. Asimov's books like I, Robot and the Foundation Trilogy have made him one of America's most influential science fiction writers. This year, he was honored with a Nebula Award that named him Grand Master of Science Fiction. He's also one of our most prolific writers with 366 books under his belt. Many of those books explain scientific phenomena and offer his projections about life in the future. Asimov's latest book is Fantastic Voyage 2, a follow-up to the novelization he wrote of the 1966 film Fantastic Voyage. Isaac Asimov emigrated with his parents to America from the Soviet Union in 1923 when he was 3 years old. They settled in Brooklyn, New York. I spoke with him from the NPR Bureau in New York. We started off with his childhood. These are the science fiction magazines that first hooked him on the genre.
The very first one was Amazing Stories in 1929. I then passed on to Science Wonder Stories and Air Wonder Stories. And finally, in 1930, when a new magazine came out called Astounding Stories, I read that. In short, I read all the science fiction magazines there were.
How did you discover them?
My father had a candy store, and I discovered them on his newsstand. He wouldn't let me read the magazines, but I convinced him that science fiction dealt with science. And he let me read that, which is a good thing.
It's funny that he should be selling them but not allowing his son to read them.
Oh, that was not at all funny. I presented him with that paradox myself. And he said, well, he was not responsible for other people, but he was responsible for the welfare of his son.
Were your parents determined that you should be a doctor or a lawyer?
My father wanted me to be a doctor, and I didn't want to be, but being a obedient son, I applied to medical school, and to my great relief, I was rejected. So I went on for chemistry.
I guess the chemistry helped more in your science fiction writing and science writing than the medical degree would have.
Well, it's not that so much. It's just that medical school would have taken up all my time and I wouldn't have been able to write. So that it was would not have been a good idea for me to go to medical school, aside from the fact I would have hated being a doctor.
You had your first story published in 1938 in Astounding Science Fiction, which was one of the magazines that you mentioned you used to read. John Campbell was the editor then, and he was one of the most influential science fiction editors. And you worked with him for many years. What was the early advice that he gave you about your writing?
Well, I'm not sure that he gave me general advice. He would point out where I had gone wrong in specific stories. And what he told me afterwards was that he had high hopes for me because I listened to what he said and apparently took advantage and learned from what he said. Incidentally, he published my third story. My first two stories were published in Amazing Stories. They were Campbell rejects.
Oh, really?
Yes.
What was your very first story that you published?
Marooned Off Vesta. And I sold it on October 21st, 1938, and it appeared in the stands in the March 1939 issue of Amazing Stories, which hit the stands on January 9th, 1939, 1 week after my 19th birthday. So that next year I'll be celebrating my golden anniversary as a professional writer.
Were your parents impressed when you actually got into print?
Yes, they were. My father especially. He would send letters to all his friends, and fortunately he stopped after three or four had appeared.
So it would have taken a lot of letters if he wrote every time you got published.
Yes.
So what was that first story about?
It was a ship that had gone through the asteroid belt and was hit by an asteroid, and there was just a piece of it left with three men on board, and they had to get themselves down to the asteroid Vesta, which was nearby. And I made it sound as exciting as I could possibly manage. And they bought it. They paid me $64 for it.
Now, what did you base those early stories on? On actual science knowledge that you had or on other science fiction stories that you read?
Mostly on other science fiction stories, although they got me interested in science, and I gradually learned science as a result. But science fiction was an even earlier influence.
The more you learned about science, were you able to get further away from using other science fiction as source material?
Well, I was, you know, you use other science fiction as source material from the standpoint of atmosphere and just how to write. But the science itself gave me the raw material for the plots.
What were those early science fiction magazines like? What did they look like? What kind of illustrations did they have? What was the feel of it?
Those early magazines were larger than the magazines, the science fiction magazines of nowadays. Some were actually the size of the Slicks, you know, the Sat Evening Post, things like that. Usually they're made of cheap paper with rough edges. They paid a half cent a word to a cent a word. And the only way you could possibly make a living out of this pulp fiction was to write a great deal and quickly and without undue revision. And I learned how to do that in those days. I thought that was the way to write. I didn't know any better. And I've kept that up ever since. And so as a result, I now have published 366 books, and I'm making a good living out of it.
Well, seriously, do you think that getting paid by the word taught you to be wordy?
No, but it certainly taught me to work hard and long, because they didn't pay much by the word. So that you couldn't spend much time in polishing and in producing beautifully crafted prose. That way you starve to death. And so I learned to write quickly and under all circumstances. I couldn't wait for inspiration to hit. I couldn't wait until I had, say, 5 straight hours of peace and quiet. I had to write whenever I had 15 minutes that I could squeeze in.
How old were you when you started to be able to support yourself from your writing?
Well, it depends on what you mean by support yourself. I was able to put myself through school, through college and graduate school, on my earnings, and I was able to supplement my income during the years when I worked as a professor at Boston University School of Medicine. I still keep the title, by the way. But it wasn't until I was in my late 30s that I could look forward to actually making a good living on writing alone. So I was not an overnight success.
Science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov is my guest, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2. It's a sequel to The Fantastic Voyage. Now, you coined the term robotics in a story that I think you wrote in 1942.
That's right. The story was called Runaround. And I had someone I had someone refer to the three laws of robotics, and that was the In fact, I think they called them three rules the first time I mentioned them. But that was the first time the word robotics was ever used in print in the English language. And I get the credit for it in the Oxford English Dictionary.
That must be a thrill.
Yeah. Two other words also I get the credit for.
Oh, really? Which ones?
One is psychohistory, which I was the first to use in my Foundation series. And the other is positronic, which I was the first to use in connection with my robots.
No, wait, what's positronic?
Well, it's the same as electronic, except instead of electrons, he used the opposite sort of particles called positrons. They were only discovered in 1934, and 5 years later I began to speak of positronic brains instead of electronic ones. And I happened to be the first one to do that. But it's a logical word. All three words are logical words, you see. If I hadn't used them, someone else would have, but I did.
Well, before we get to psychohistory, let's go back to robotics. Well, tell us how you came up with the word.
Well, I thought that was the word. You know, what's the science dealing with the study of robots, the maintenance of robots, the design of robots? Almost all the branches of physics end in ICS, physics itself, hydraulics, celestial mechanics, statics, electrodynamics. The ICS is the usual physics ending, so I figured that if you're going to deal with robots, the science is robotics.
Would you review the three rules of robotics that you came up with?
Well, I eventually called them three laws. Number one is a robot may not harm a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm. Second law is a robot must obey orders given it by a human being, except where that would conflict with the first law. And the third is a robot must protect its own existence, except where that would conflict with the first or second laws.
Now, these were rules for robot designers?
That's right. And as a matter of fact, they're taken seriously. In other words, a great many of the early people who worked in robotics were more or less inspired by my robot stories, and they knew the three laws, and they realized that if they could develop robots that obeyed them, that would be great. So far, the robots we have are still extremely simple computerized levers. They're not complex enough to have the three laws built into them.
What were the robots that you envisioned in the 1940s when you were writing this story?
Well, they were typical robots that were used in science fiction. They were made of metal, and they had a roughly humanoid shape. My contribution was that they were designed with safeguards. That's what the three laws were. Until my robots came in, mostly what robot stories consisted of was robots being built and then destroying their creators. It was the Frankenstein story told over and over and over and over again. And I took the attitude that robots would be machines, and that one of the chief concerns of those who built them was to make it impossible for them to do harm. That apparently struck everyone as sensible, because after my stories became popular, the old-fashioned robot stories disappeared, and the new kinds of robot stories, even when they didn't quote my laws, which, of course, they didn't like to because they were mine, they simply assumed they existed, and so did the readers.
You know, maybe we're returning to the old kind of robots again. I'm thinking of the movie RoboCop, in which the robot finally does destroy its creator.
Well, you have to understand that in general, the movies are some 50 years behind printed science fiction, so that the level of the movies we get is roughly the level of science fiction, real science fiction of the 1930s.
Let's move on to another word that you coined, and that is psychohistory. And that was in your Foundation trilogy. And it's really the science of group behavior reduced to mathematical equations.
Yes, exactly. Of course, Erik Erikson, who's a psychiatrist, invented the word psychohistory as a way of determining historical changes as affected by the psychiatric qualities of important men like Woodrow Wilson or Albert Einstein or Sigmund Freud or Adolf Hitler. And that use of the word psychohistory is more common than my use, but it was invented later.
What did you have in mind when you coined the term and the concept?
Well, I wanted to write a short story about the fall of the Galactic Empire. I just finished reading The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire the second time, and I thought I might as well adapt it to on a much larger scale to the Galactic Empire and get a story out of it. And my editor, John Campbell, was much taken with the idea and said he didn't want it wasted on a short story. He wanted it an open-ended series that would last forever, perhaps. And so I started doing that. In order to keep the series going from story to story, I was essentially writing future history. And I had to make it sufficiently different from modern history to give it that science fictional touch. And so I assumed that the time would come when there would be a science in which things could be predicted on a probabilistic or statistical basis.
Do you think that would be good if there really was such a science?
Well, I can't help but think it would be good, except that in my stories, I always have opposing views. In other words, people argue all possible ways of looking at psychohistory and deciding whether it's good or bad. So you can't really tell. I happen to feel sort of on the optimistic side. I think if we can somehow get across some of the problems that face us now, humanity has a glorious future, and that if we could use the tenets of psychohistory to guide ourselves, we might avoid a great many troubles. But on the other hand, it might create troubles. It's impossible to tell in advance.
My guest is Isaac Asimov, the science and science fiction writer, and his latest book is called Fantastic Voyage 2, Destination Brain. We're going to talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Isaac Asimov is my guest. You know, for years you've really been writing more science than you have science fiction. How come?
Oh, well, until 1958, I wrote mostly science fiction. But then when Sputnik went up and everyone in the United States got scared that we were falling behind in science, I felt it was absolutely necessary for anyone who knew science and could write to try his hand at educating the American public. So I deliberately stopped writing science fiction, mostly, and started writing science books. And that went on for 21 years, and then Doubleday got tired. And they said they wanted me to go back to writing science fiction novels. And they were very persuasive. And so I wrote Foundation's Edge, which was a continuation of the old Foundation series that I'd written 30 years earlier. And it hit the bestseller list, stayed on for 25 weeks. To my intense surprise, it was my 262nd book. And until then, I thought I had a perfect score, you know, that I knew exactly how to miss the bestseller list. I'd done it 261 times in a row, and flopping on the 262nd surprised me. But after that, Doubleday wouldn't be stopped. They wanted a novel every year, and I've been writing them, and they've been doing very, very well, I'm glad to say, because they're hard to do.
Had you lost your interest in science fiction during that hiatus?
No, not at all. But I had thought that the field had gotten beyond me. You know, it's a rapidly developing field, and the science fiction that's written today isn't at all like the science fiction I wrote in my time. And I felt that I was just a quaint hangover from a previous generation, and that it would show. And I didn't make any effort to write in the 80s fashion, let us say. They wanted another Foundation book. I wrote it exactly as I wrote my Foundation books in the 1940s. And it seemed to go well. So I continued writing in my way, regardless of any changes that had taken place. And there seemed to be enough people who are willing to read my stuff, written in its way, for it to be reasonably successful. So I'm happy.
What are the changes that have taken place in the science fiction genre that you're referring to?
Well, for one thing, they've gone away from, for the most part, there are always exceptions, but they've moved away from being preoccupied with science and technological advance and moved in the direction of social effects. That's content. And then stylistically, things are much freer now. You can be much more realistic. You can make use of words you weren't allowed to make use of in my day. You could describe actions that you weren't allowed to describe in my day, and so on. And as a matter of fact, it's now terribly passé not to do that sort of thing. And so in my last few books, just as an experiment, I wiped out all vulgarisms whatsoever, even hells and dams, you know. I just didn't use them. I wanted to see if I would get letters telling me that, hey, there isn't a single expletive anywhere in your books. That's not real. That's not the way people speak. I never got a single letter to that effect, not one. Nobody seemed to notice. So I figured, well, what the heck? Why bother sticking in all that stuff when it doesn't come natural to me?
Your new book is a sequel to Fantastic Voyage. You wrote the novelization of the movie. And in the new book, a team of scientists miniaturize themselves to travel to the brain of a Soviet scientist who has many, many secrets that they want to unravel. Why did you want to do a Fantastic Voyage 2?
Well, you see, it's not exactly a sequel. What happened was Fantastic Voyage, the first book, was a movie. And they came to me with a movie script and asked if I would novelize it. And I did, for a small, flat sum, largely because I'd never done anything of the sort. And it took me only 6 weeks to do it. And it was turned out to be a huge success, quite independent of the movie. Usually these movie throwaway things, once the movie's through, they're thrown away. But this one, it's still in print, both in hardcover and in softcover, and still selling more than 20 years after the movie had its play. So, but I never was really happy with it because it hadn't been my own imagination. I took it from the movie. And what's more, I couldn't write any more on the subject because the story belonged to the movie people. And then someone bought the rights to the title. Only the title, not the characters, not the events. Only the title. And they came to me and asked me to write Fantastic Voyage 2. And eventually I agreed. And this time I made use of my own imagination. I told a story of submarines inside the human body as I wanted to tell it. And whether that makes it better or worse, I'll leave it for others to decide. But I was much happier with the second one.
Well, in Fantastic Voyage 2, the destination is the brain. I think it's fair to say that you've been pretty obsessed with the brain over the years. You've written a lot of science books and science essays about the brain. And I think, is it fair to say that that's the organ of the body that interests you most?
Well, in a way, yes. In the first place, that's the way I make my living. I mean, I use my brain such as it is. And in the second place, it is at once the most hopeful and the most dangerous part of the human body. Most hopeful because solutions to problems arise from the human brain, and the most dangerous because the problems themselves also arise from the human brain. It's the thoughts, the ideas, the genius that solve the problems, but it's our tendency towards hatreds and fears and suspicions that create the problems. And we don't know how the brain works. So that naturally makes it all the more interesting.
I think a lot of people live in fear as they get older that the power of their brain is going to diminish with age. Is that something that you've worried about?
No, you can't help but worry about such things. After all, I've depended all my life on a rather remarkable memory. So I don't take notes. I don't keep cross-filed indexes or anything. Everything gets piled into my head and stays there. And I call it up whenever I need it. And I know that as one gets older and older, that the brain, like any other part of the body, gradually deteriorates. And so I keep waiting for my memory to start going. It's a frightening thing. Every time I can't think of a word, I say, oh, there it goes. But so far it's managing. I am now 67, and I'm still going along full speed. How much longer I can manage, I don't know. But every added day is a day of glory for me.
You know, your book, Fantastic Voyage, reminded me in a way of an essay that you wrote a few years ago about a triple heart bypass that you had. And in that essay, you described having an angiogram, which is where they basically inject dye into an artery so that they could monitor the flow of blood through the heart. And you had the option of watching the angiogram on the video screen that your heart was being monitored on, but you wrote that you turned your head and you didn't want to watch it.
No, I didn't.
For the author of Fantastic Voyage, describing all these scientists journeying through the body's bloodstream, I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but, you know, it's like that old statement saying that the management is not responsible for the views expressed in this program. Well, I'm the management, and I'm not responsible for the views presented in my my stories. I travel all over the galaxy. In real life, I hate to travel, and I never go in airplanes. When I wrote a book called The Human Body, I described every conceivable disease and bad working that I could think of without a shudder. But in real life, I'm very queasy.
Well, what made you turn your head from that video?
I didn't want to see anything probing through my blood vessels to my heart. It just didn't strike me as an aesthetic experience.
Well, now we could get to your fear of planes. For someone who wrote about a spacewalk before astronauts actually landed on the moon, yet you're afraid to fly planes. That's quite a paradox.
Well, I'm not sure that I'm afraid to fly them. I just
don't trust
never
them.
Got into the habit of it, that's all. And now it's too late. I just don't want to. But that's part of a bigger problem. I just hate to travel by any means. I like to stay where I am. I never leave Manhattan voluntarily. And I don't know why that is. When I'm forced to travel, it doesn't bother me very much. It's just that I happen to like it at home.
You once wrote that we should not see science or technology as inevitable destroyers or saviors. Does that kind of sum up your view of technology?
That's right. It's technology is neutral. That is, it depends on how it's used. It's up to us to use it wisely or foolishly. And often our intentness on immediate gain, on short-term goals, causes us to use it foolishly without due regard for the long-term harm we might do. And that's sad, of course, but on the other hand, it's understandable. It's very difficult for human beings to take the long view and to give up the immediate profit.
With that said, are there any breakthroughs or inventions that you really would like to see happen?
Oh, I want to see how. I want to have people find out just how the brain works. And that, to me, is the most important conceivable problem to be solved in the world. And on a lesser scale, I would like to see a space-centered society. I want to see the human range extended. I want to see mining stations on the moon and huge settlements in orbit around the Earth. I would like to see power plants in orbit and factories. I would like to see as much as possible of Earth's industrial plant moved into space so that we don't foul our own nest with waste products. Of course, people say, well, then we'll just foul space. But space is much larger, and space has an automatic cleaning device called the solar wind, so that things might be better up there. Oddly enough, the pollution of space is not so much the ordinary chemical wastes and all that. It's the fragments of satellites that are beginning to worry people, because they stay in orbit. Billions and countless billions of little particles, sometimes just of paint, which are moving around at 5 miles a second, and which when they strike can do damage even when they're very light. So we're going to have to figure out ways of sweeping up space, for instance.
If there were space colonies in your lifetime, would you dare to travel to them?
No, not me. Not me, but someone has to stay on Earth, and I volunteer.
Isaac Asimov, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
My guest has been science and science fiction writer Isaac Asimov. His latest book, Fantastic Voyage 2, is published by Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.